Hello and welcome to Foreign Interest. My name is Oren Depp.
And my name is Jacqueline White.
And we are two college students at the McCain Institute for International Leadership who want to help people understand the world abroad and make our discussion smarter, deeper, and stronger. Our topic today is Ukraine and Russia.
And today we have a very special guest, Ambassador Kurt Volker. Ambassador Volker is the current executive director for the McCain Institute of International Leadership in Washington, D.C., and is a leading expert in U.S. foreign and national security policy with 30 years of experience in the public and private sectors. Thank you for joining us and welcome.
Oren, Jackie, great to be here. Thank you for inviting me and congratulations on this initiative.
Thank you.
So Ambassador Volker has also served a variety of capacities on the foreign stage. He was an ambassador to NATO. He was an advisor on the National Security Council for President George W. Bush. And most recently, he is the special representative for Ukraine. On that note, could you tell us just a little bit more about your current role in Ukraine?
Right. So this is a voluntary role. About a year and a half ago, then Secretary of State Tillerson asked if I would be willing to be a U.S. special representative for Ukraine negotiations. There is a conflict going on in Ukraine. There is an agreement that's not being implemented. It's called the Minsk Agreement. There are diplomatic negotiations that go on. France and Germany play a particular leading role together with Ukraine and Russia. But he wanted to have the U.S. be represented at a high level. And these other countries were looking for a U.S. interlocutor as well. So he asked if I would take that on. Said I would be delighted to do so, but we got to be clear about one thing, which is what are we trying to accomplish? And I said, my view is that we need to be seeking to restore the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine and to help ensure the safety and security of all Ukrainian citizens, regardless of ethnicity, nationality, or religion. And if that is the U.S. goal, then count me in. And he confirmed, indeed, that is exactly what we are trying to do.
So Ukraine will be holding their 2019 presidential election on the 31st of March, and they have some interesting candidates running. Mm-hmm. Their current president, Petro Poroshenko, is running for re-election against frontrunner and comedian Volodymyr Zelensky and former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. How do you see the outcome of Ukraine's presidential election impacting the EU and NATO?
Well, first off, it is vital for Ukraine that they have a successful democratic election. They've had ups and downs in the course of the last 20-some years of building their democratic institutions. They had an Orange Revolution in 2005 as people going to the streets to demand change. Change came about, but then that government that followed that, Yushchenko and Tymoshenko at that time was prime minister, didn't really deliver on the reforms that people were looking for. The next election cycle, a guy named Yanukovych got elected. He's famous because if you hear about Paul Manafort, that's who he was working for. Yanukovych was moving slowly towards getting Ukraine close to the European Union and then did an about face. That took people into the streets. Again, it caused an upheaval in Ukraine. It's called the Maidan, where people went to the square, the Maidan Square, and protested this decision. When they went out to protest, Yanukovych took out the security forces and killed 100 people. This caused the parliament to then say, well, then you can't be president. We're going to take away your powers as president. And then he fled the country. So then Ukraine had to have new elections again. That's how Poroshenko got elected. And now this is the first time since then where they're really having an open, fair election for the presidency. That's what you mentioned, March 31st, the first round. Second round, I believe it is April 21st. And then parliamentary elections will follow this fall. So this is crucial for Ukraine to get it right and have good elections. The second thing is, well, then who wins or how does this come out? Poroshenko is the current president, kind of a known quantity. Ukraine has done a lot in reform in the last 3 years, more so than the previous 20, but still nowhere near enough compared to what it needs to do. Tymoshenko is a known quantity as well. She was prime minister before. She did some things. She did other things. You know, people are going to make their own judgment about whether they want to see her back. And then you have someone who's completely from outside, who is a comedian. He has a television show, which you can see on Netflix, called Servant to the People, and he portrays a president of Ukraine. And so you might think that this is an interesting combination of the virtual and the real into an actual presidential campaign. I've met with all three of them. I think they're all credible as candidates. They are dividing the vote, you know, reasonably equally. The comedian is actually leading in opinion polls, but because he's never been in politics before, you don't know if that translates into votes or not. And we'll have to see how that comes out. First round will narrow it down to two people, and then it becomes a head-to-head in the second round. Now, if I can then move on, the other part of your question was, what does this mean for NATO and the EU? NATO and the EU are big, okay? So we've got 28, 29 countries in these organizations. It's all of Western Europe, Central Europe, U.S. and Canada and NATO. And what we care about as that community is the sanctity of international borders, the advance of freedom and democracy so that societies are healthy, prosperity, trade, stability, security, so that there's not conflict going on, and how Ukraine fares, both in terms of the conflict that's going on with Russia attacking Ukraine, as well as the integrity of Ukraine's borders, matters for security and prosperity and development in Europe as a whole. So we want to see Ukraine be a successful market democracy that has its international borders respected and that creates security. If that's what happens with Ukraine, it'll make a more secure Europe and it'll be a great signal for the people of Russia.
There's a lot of history regarding Ukraine and Russia, but also Ukraine and the U.S. For instance, Ukraine applied to join NATO in 2008, but was delayed to a point where following Ukrainian administrations lost interest. As such, do you see the U.S. as having made any fundamental errors in its previous approach towards Ukraine?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because the big story here, go from 1989, when the Berlin Wall came down, until the present. So you're looking at a 30-year period here. You now have 100 plus million people across Central and Eastern Europe, Poles, Hungarians, Czechs, whatever, who live in free democratic societies, growing economies, and are secure compared to the situation before that. So this process of NATO enlargement has been tremendously empowering for people. Why would Europe be divided? Why would Western Europe be prosperous and democratic and not Eastern Europe when the history and culture and everything goes back centuries is the same? So this has been a tremendous development. Every country in Europe, every European democracy has the right to apply for membership in NATO. They can seek it in the European Union as well. That's Article 10 of the NATO Treaty. And, of course, the Georgians and the Ukrainians and the Moldovans, they would, and the Bosnians and others, they would like to be members of NATO. NATO had a process that started really after the Berlin Wall came down in 89, accelerated in 95, which was to say, okay, the door's open. No, we have a treaty. It says more countries can join. You have to do the homework. You have to get ready. That you need to be a democracy, a market economy, civil control of the military, interoperability, settle your conflicts with your neighbors, contribute to security of the alliance as a whole, so that you're not a security liability, you're a security contributor. So countries did that. Poland did that, Hungary did that, and so on. So we ended up expanding NATO with these countries. Ukraine is not currently in the position that it is settled all these things, either in terms of its democracy or its reforms, or, you know, what does it mean for security of Europe today? So it has some distance to go. Same with some other countries as well. Georgia's actually done a lot better. So, you know, those are the issues there. The one thing that went differently with Ukraine and two things that went differently with Ukraine and Georgia compared to the others. One of them is in the 2008 Bucharest summit that NATO had. Instead of giving those countries the membership action plan, which was NATO's training program, and say, okay, you want to be a member of NATO? Go through the membership action plan. Go do these steps. We'll decide whether you're going to be a member of NATO later after you've done that. Well, the Bucharest summit, it kind of got turned around. And we said, Georgia and Ukraine will be members of NATO, but we didn't give them the toolbox. And so they're saying, well, when will we be members of NATO and what do we do? And it's become very vague and fuzzy. So that's one thing that I think kind of got messed up. But the other thing to remember is that when NATO enlarged in the early 2000s with the Baltic states and Slovenia, Slovakia, Romania, Bulgaria, or Poland, Czech Republic, and Hungary before that, you had a Russia that wanted to have its legitimate security concerns addressed, but was not fundamentally opposed to this. You now have a Russia that is authoritarian at home, attacking its neighbors, occupying territory, taking it from them, and vehemently opposed to NATO membership. And so this causes NATO members, especially in Western Europe, to worry what's going to happen if we bring countries into NATO. So we have both a process that got a little bit off, but also a much more aggressive Russia than we had before. And that has made this a more complicated process. The end of the day, however, I think the principles that NATO stands for and has always stood for are still the right ones, that we support the values, freedom, democracy, rule of law, human rights, market economy, etc. And we believe that everybody has an equal right to security. And so if they meet the standards, they can become a member, and it's just a matter of building that security over time.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see that sometimes Russia can see NATO membership as an act of aggression towards them.
Sure, read Article 5. It is all about defense.
Yeah.
An attack against one is an attack on all, so the countries agree to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. NATO makes decisions by consensus of all the member states, and the idea of NATO reaching a consensus to go attack somebody is kind of unfathomable that you could do that. The only cases you can think of where there's been a crisis going on, like in Kosovo or Bosnia or Libya, where NATO has launched airstrikes or an action to try to establish peace again. But to actually proactively launch a campaign against somebody, least of all Russia, is kind of unfathomable.
With hindsight, we know that Russia's invasion of Georgia in 2008 set the stage for Russia's current revanchist ambitions and allowed the Kremlin to sort of reassert itself in the region. So how would you say the Russo-Georgian conflict and subsequent lack of response from the U.S. and NATO contribute to the developments in Ukraine? Or do they at all?
Yeah, so I think several things I would take issue with in the way the question is phrased. first off, the Russia's attack on Georgia was not the precursor to things. It was the consequence of things. That President Putin in February 2007 at the Munich Security Conference essentially declared we are, he had previously said the collapse of the Soviet Union is the greatest tragedy of the 20th century, and we're not going to sit around and take it anymore. We're going to be much more assertive in promoting our interests. And they spent 2 years from 2006 to 2008 preparing the ground for this attack on Georgia. Everything from shooting down Georgian drones that were trying to overfly Georgia's own territory, taking out a radar system on Georgian territory from Russian fighters, an intervention briefly into the one of the valleys where they said there were terrorists there, which was very provocative or threatening for Georgia to have Russian troops threatening to intervene inside Georgian territory. They had Russian so-called peacekeepers under a UN mandate in Abkhazia and South Ossetia that are allegedly there together with Georgians, but they had increasingly become much more assertive in controlling the territory, in supporting the local governments as independent actors. They've now recognized them as independent states. They changed the mix of forces compared to what you were allowed to have under the UN. They brought in engineering forces. They could reinforce the bridges so the tanks wouldn't crash. It was a couple of year effort to prepare for this invasion into Georgia, which they then did. I'd say the most important thing that Russians concluded from this is that their military forces were not as nimble as they thought. And so they spent a couple more years getting better so that when they invaded Ukraine, they were much better at it.
More prepared. Wow. Yeah.
When you talked about a lot about Ukraine and how it wasn't necessarily a direct tie to Georgia and the current situation with Ukraine, but a lot of people do see Ukraine as a very important domino in Eastern Europe, and that any lack of action by the West could set a precedent that Russia could abuse. So what do you think are the U.S.'s future fears within Eastern Europe, and do you think those fears are ultimately justified?
Well, I think you first look at what is the nature of President Putin's rule in Russia and what is he doing in his policies abroad. It has become increasingly authoritarian. Just last week, the Duma passed a law that makes it illegal to criticize the government on the internet. That's pretty jarring. That, it's a very Soviet era sort of thing. They have essentially taken over the media with just a couple minor exceptions. They have taken over political opposition, with the exception of Navalny, who is indicted for a felony which makes him ineligible to run for president in the future, and they keep close tabs on that. You've seen murders of journalists, murder of the opposition leader Boris Nemtsov. So it has been quite a clampdown in Russia. You've also seen Russia increasingly aggressive abroad, whether it's their military deployments globally. I was just reading an article about the increasing Russian naval presence in the North Atlantic. You have their invasion of Georgia, their invasion of Ukraine, and so forth. So that's the situation. Let's also throw in their intervention in Syria. That's the situation that we have. What has happened over the past few years, I would argue, and we'll circle back to Georgia in a second too, is you've seen the United States and NATO, transatlantic community, build a stronger and more sustainable policy to try to push back on these Russian encroachments. That's because Russia, if unchecked, can become encouraged and say, well, we took Crimea, that was easy, let's try eastern Ukraine. And that turned out to be harder. What we would worry about is trying something in the Baltic states because we have a treaty obligation to help defend those countries. We don't want to be in a conflict with Russia. Nobody does. So it's very important that we show resolve, will, military capacity to fulfill our obligations of collective defense so that it deters any aggression and ends up creating stability. And I would argue that in the past couple of years, we've seen an increase in stability as so far as it applies to NATO members. We've seen increased U.S. troop presence in Europe, further forward deployment of that presence, other countries from NATO joining the United States in that presence further forward, greater military exercises. Just next week, you're going to see a military exercise in Georgia that will involve U.S. military forces. And there will be a B-52 bomber flying over the Black Sea. We had the USS Donald Ross, a guided missile destroyer, visit the port of Odessa a couple of weeks ago. These things all add up to creating a capacity that shows a resolve and a deterrent against future aggression. So that's what we're trying to avoid, a new aggression or conflict, by having this kind of capacity in place and what we'd be concerned about. Now, I want to come back to Georgia on one thing, too, because I was very involved with that at the time. I was in the State Department just before Russia invaded and immediately went to be ambassador to NATO during the course of their invasion still ongoing.
It was an exciting time.
Yeah, it was. It was. And what I would say about that is we did a lot of things that helped bring the conflict to a quick conclusion in terms of active fighting. Yeah, it was very short in that respect. We had U.S. C-17 aircraft gather Georgian soldiers who were fighting in Iraq and take them back to Georgia so that they could go back to the front line and defend their country. So we actually flew them there for that with a big U.S. military aircraft. We put a couple destroyers into the Black Sea off the coast of Georgia. We had Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice go to Tbilisi with a couple of European foreign ministers to show support for Georgia. We were coordinating with the European Union, and Sarkozy was the president of France and president of the European Union at the time. He went to Moscow and was pushing them to implement a ceasefire. And we ended up, within a few days, having a hammered-out basic ceasefire agreement that called for parties to go back to where they were before the fighting started. Now, Russia has never fully implemented that, but it at least stopped the immediate fighting, and Russian tanks did pull back from Georgian territory outside of South Ossetia and Abkhazia back to the territory of South Ossetia and Abkhazia within Georgia. So there was, I think, a lot of activity and support at the time, which made a difference. You compare that to what happened with Crimea, and I think it really is disturbing, because you had Russia put in his little green men, start taking over Crimea, and we were, at the time, urging Ukraine not to resist this militarily. Russia moved very swiftly, took the territory, sealed it off, then held a sham referendum, and then annexed the territory before anybody did anything. And that was quite jarring. When they then saw how easy it was and tried to do the same thing again in eastern Ukraine, people did react more. The Ukrainians fought back. It created a stalemate. And European diplomats, in particular France and Germany, jumped into action to try to then freeze that fighting. Didn't work as well as in the case of Georgia, but it did at least create a line on the on the Ukrainian map, where we know where the ceasefire is supposed to be, and that only is at least some progress. But there is still active fighting going on every night in Ukraine. People are still getting killed every week, and it still should be high on our agenda.
You kind of mentioned a little bit earlier about deterrence, and now with nuclear deterrence being a key pillar of American security, especially in Europe, where U.S. conventional responses to conflict or aggression face challenges, mm-hmm. how has extended deterrence in Europe impacted our relationship with Russia, and how do you see the future of arms control affecting the dynamic?
That's a great question, because arms control has been a key element of threat reduction and creating stability and security. So arms control has played a very useful role in the past. But in order for arms control to do that, people have to respect the agreements. And Russia in 2007 said it's going to stop implementing the CFE treaty, started violating the flank limits. So that, you know, they're supposed to be a thinning out of forces to avoid concentrations on the flanks. They said, we're going to start disregarding that. And they have been out of compliance with CFE ever since. For the past several years, they've also been out of compliance with the INF Treaty, which is what the Trump administration has now focused on. They've developed and deployed ground-launched missiles of a certain range that are supposed to be banned by the treaty. So it's, I think, an important step by the administration, when your partner in this agreement is violating it, to call that a violation and to suspend the implementation of that treaty, because it is in fact not doing its purpose anymore. The way we got to the INF treaty, and the way we got to the CFE treaty, was through arms buildups. We had massive conventional armed forces in Europe from both NATO and the Warsaw Pact up until 1988-89. And the CFE Treaty, because that was an unacceptable standoff, CFE Treaty was negotiated and acceptably brought them down. Both sides wanted to see that reduction in conventional forces. Same thing with INF. The Soviets at the time were deploying missiles that we said, you know, we don't want to see those deployed. So we threatened to put in Pershing short-range missiles into Germany. That caused a negotiation about short-range missiles and caused us also to be able to take a further step and say, and let's have zero in the class of intermediate missiles, because, you know, we didn't have them at the time, and let's not get them. That was great for as long as it lasted, but now we're in a situation where Russia stopped adhering to that, so I think we have to push back on that. The deterrent aspect is therefore critical to establishing security and establishing a basis for negotiations and arms control. Because if you aren't willing to deploy the capacity and have the will to use it if pushed, then there's no reason for the other side to negotiate an agreement. And so you've got to have a balance of forces in place and then be prepared to negotiate, and then you can accomplish something.
Right. It gives us leverage at the table.
It gives us both a reason to come to an agreement. Otherwise, there's no reason to negotiate from the other side.
Yeah, thank you. You put that very well.
So there's definitely a sense that we have had a long history of conflict with Russia, but it also lends to a sense that there is almost a continual and promised conflict with us and Russia. Russia has repeatedly tried expanding its influence through power and actual territorial control of sovereign nations. And so knowing this, can you please explain the future U.S. strategy towards Russian expansionism?
Well, let's hope that Russian expansionism stops. I mean, that should be the goal, right? What we would want for Russia is for the Russian people to live in a democratic, prosperous, safe, secure society within their own borders. Like anybody else, we would want that for the Russian people. That's going to make the best possible Russia for the people that live there. The problem is those people don't get to choose governments that do that for them. And as a result, those governments keep looking externally to create a conflict and gin up nationalism and militarist sentiment to justify why they should be in charge of those other people at home, rather than having a developmentally focused democracy. And as long as we have that kind of government in Russia, I think we should be concerned about Russia continuing to try to attack its neighbors and take territory and things like that. But that shouldn't be the way Russia is forever. Russia is a great country, great people, history, culture, natural resources. They should be doing much better for their people than they are. And if they did, you probably wouldn't have as expansionist a Russia as you have today.
Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you, Ambassador Volker, for taking the time out of your day to answer our questions, and best of luck in negotiations. Special thanks to the McCain Institute for providing us with the necessary equipment and the possibility of interviewing Ambassador Volker. And for our listeners out there, thanks for listening in, and we hope you've learned as much as we have.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Volker.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.